Thank you, Arnav. So the good thing about being the last speaker is I get to thank the entire body of organizers across the continents. So I was hoping we could all unmute ourselves briefly and just give them a big, big round of applause, the entire group of organizers all over. Thank you, guys. And now if you could unmute yourself, I mean, sorry, mute yourself. Thank you. The good thing about having these virtual conferences is that you don't have to go all over the place and learn cool things. I wish things like this were available when I was a grad student. Unfortunately, things were different back then. And so, over the years, I've tried to understand physics, mathematical physics, and try to sort of bring myself to a point where I can make a statement and it's not utterly bogus. Of course, over the years, you make wrong statements, but then people check it and then they fix it. And that's one of the big virtues of these conferences. And I learned a whole heck of a lot this week. But what I want to do today is sort of use some of the language that I think I understand and put it in the perspective that a topologist could understand. So part of this talk is going to be straightforward for a physicist, maybe an insult to their intelligence, but helpful to a topologist, and the other part will be the other way around. Let me begin with sort of take you through my stream of consciousness. Let me take you through the way I see the whole question of elliptic cohomology. So I'm going to start with a thought experiment. Can everybody see the top of the screen?
It's good to me.
So let's start with a thought experiment. And let's assume that we are looking for a cohomology theory, let's call that E, so that if you have a 2D conformal field theory of, say, central charge N, whatever these things mean, one gets a class, let's call that bracket C, in the nth cohomology of En.
Actually, sorry, if you're writing something, I don't see it. I just see your title slide right now. Are you writing something?
You don't see the first.
I see your title slide saying Wiener zero conformal blocks and elliptic cohomology. If you're writing something, I'm not seeing it.
I don't know why you're not seeing the slides that I'm bringing
Oh,
up.
that's perfect. I am now seeing it. That's beautiful.
Okay, sorry. Is this okay?
Yeah, that looks good to me.
Okay, so let's assume, like I said, you have a conformal field theory of central charge N, and so that one gets a class in the nth cohomology or homotopy of a point, and let's call that C. So let's try to make sense of this relation here. And in the first talk that David gave, we talked about something like this. Like, what does it mean to take the direct sum of a conformal field theory with itself? And presumably, in this theory, you'd like to say that when the conformal field theory is added to itself, that's the same as twice that conformal field theory in this group. One way to make sense of it is to assume that C is some element in a Grothendieck group of modules over some underlying object that right now remains undefined. So that would be a place where this equality here could be made sense of. So also, let's further assume that we have something called the character map, which is, I'll write it as the trace of Q to the L naught from the nth homotopy of this supposed spectrum into modular forms of weight N over 2. And to be entirely honest, what I really should have said is that, this modular form is obtained by taking a slightly different function than scaling it with this eta function. So let's leave that aside for the moment. Let's not make a big deal out of it, but let's make sure this cohomology theory comes with such a function. And when you apply this guy to this class C, we get what's called the genus one partition function. So that's what you expect. This character map should evaluate to give you the genus one partition function on a conformal field theory. Now, this turns out to be the trace of another operator that's called the genus zero evolution operator. So we'll talk about that later. So, but the point I want to make here is that the information of the trace here seems to depend on genus zero information, even though it's called the genus one partition function. So far, it seems to me that the objects we're studying really depend on genus zero information and can be bootstrapped from up there. So let's think of the bare bones basic object that would allow us to make sense of this first point and second point, and then let's see if that leads us anywhere. You know, let's follow our nose, see where it goes. So what that leads us to is to the category of modules over vertex operator algebras. So I'm not going to be as brave as Geert Laurens tried to be to explain the definition of a vertex operator algebra. I'll sort of give you the important things around it. But before I get to that, let's assume there's an object called the vertex operator algebra, and let's say that a conformal field theory can be seen as a module over something like that, and that a vertex operator algebra contains information about genus zero objects. So you come across this very interesting paper. Actually, this was a hallmark paper in the theory of vertex algebras. And what it really says is this, that, by the way, the title of the paper is Moduli Invariance of Characters of Vertex Operator Algebras. What it says is this, that whatever this object is, let's say you have a nice one of those. So you have a nice vertex operator algebra, which has some finiteness properties. And you take the vector space that's spanned by the characters of these modules. And these characters turned out to be holomorphic functions in the right range. Then this vector space spanned by the characters is a finite dimensional representation of SL2Z.
And if I could just interrupt you for a second.
Sure.
A question from the chat. Theo asked if you plan to distinguish chiral conformal field theories from full conformal field theories.
I will in some second, in a few seconds. Yes.
Awesome.
So right now, everything here is chiral, whatever that means. If it makes sense to people, this paper and the results I'm stating now, let's just assume you have a chiral vertex algebra. I mean, chiral conformal field theory, but really a vertex algebra is the chiral object. So I'm calling this representation K naught. You want to think of K naught as the zeroth growth and as the growth and degroup, the zeroth K theory. So it's spanned by the characters of modules. So it has one basis element for every irreducible representation. And so that's why I'm calling it K naught. And so if you have such a vertex algebra that satisfies these finiteness properties, we'll call it rational, even though rational is a bit weaker than what you require in this paper of Zhu. He requires some extra conditions, but let's, for today's talk, call it rational and mean that it applies, that the theorem as Zhu applies. So K naught is a representation of SL2Z for vertex algebra that's rational. Okay, so what you immediately notice is that you can take this K naught and turn it into a holomorphic vector bundle over the moduli of elliptic curves in a very naive way. And you just take this. You just take H times this vector space with the SL2Z action diagonally on these objects, and it maps to H mod SL2Z. This is the moduli elliptic curves. And this is a vector bundle. It's a holomorphic vector bundle, right? So there is such an object, a holomorphic vector bundle, whose sections are giving you these interesting characters. So my goal today in the entire talk is to try, and I won't completely succeed, but I'll go quite far, in trying to make this entire statement a derived statement. So by that I mean I'm going to construct a spectrum, a K-theory spectrum, from the category of representations of your rational VOA. And the way I'm going to do that is I'm going to first assume that everything is rationalized. So all my vector spaces are over C, all my spectra are localized over C. And then at the end of the talk, the last third of the talk, I'll sort of lead you through what I think happens when you try to make everything integral. Okay, so in order to proceed further, I'd really need to give you some structure theory of these vertex algebras. I won't define them, but I'll give you some information that will hopefully give you a flavor of what the structure is underneath these vertex algebras. So let's assume you have a rational vertex algebra. It turns out the category of modules is semi-simple, meaning that it has finitely many irreducibles and you can decompose everything into a sum of irreducibles. It's semi-simple, or it's a finitely many copies of vector space. Okay. So with this data comes extra structure, and that's the structure of a modular functor. So what's a modular functor? A modular functor is an assignment of a functor from, I-fold tensor copies of the category to J-fold tensor copies of the category for every Riemann surface X with I incoming and J outgoing parametrized circle boundaries. So you, if you're given a Riemann surface X, let's say with I incoming circles, J outgoing circles, and those circles have a parametrization, then what you expect from a modular functor is an assignment of a functor, we'll call that C of X, between these many copies of C to these many copies of C. And if you glue these, there needs to be some compatibility. That is to say, if you take two Riemann surfaces with the right outgoing and incoming boundary and glue them together along the parametrization, then the functor you get for the composite Riemann surface should compare projectively to the functor you get for by composing the two functors for the individual parts of the big Riemann surface. And by that, I mean that when you look at the morphisms, they agree up to a scalar. So they're called projective functors. Okay. Now, in a situation like this, what you could do is you can take a bunch of objects on this side and a bunch of objects on this side and take this functor and compare the image of those objects with the underlying objects on the right-hand side in terms of the morphism spaces, and you end up getting a vector space. So what I mean is take a bunch of objects, I objects here and J objects here, and look at this functor and look at the morphism space between the image of this functor on those I objects and the J objects that you already assigned on the right-hand side, and that gives you a vector space. One of the things you require this vector space to have is to assemble into a projectively flat bundle over the moduli of these Riemann surfaces. Okay, so this is an important piece of data, and it's called the bundle of conformal blocks. So it's a very interesting, very important bundle over the moduli of surfaces called the bundle of conformal blocks, and it has a projectively flat connection. Okay. All right, let's look at a very baby example of conformal blocks. I'll work with surfaces that have two boundary components and at genus zero, so basically annuli. Looking at annuli, and I'll take the upper half plane as a way to parametrize some of these annuli. So here's how I'm going to do it. So let's take a tau in the upper half plane, and let's create an annulus using tau. The annulus it needs to be parametrized because that's the part of the information we require. So I'm going to take the outer boundary of my annulus as a standard unit circle, parametrized in the standard way. And the inner boundary is going to be parametrized by this description, sending a complex number z to q times z. So remember, tau is in the upper half plane, so this expression q, which I mean e to the 2 pi I tau, it has modulus strictly less than 1. And so this is, in fact, a smaller circle than the standard unit circle. And so this gives you a parametrization for the inner circle. Okay. All right, notice that this parametrization using the upper half plane actually factors through H mod Z. So this parameterization is factoring through the expression e to the 2 pi I tau. So it's factoring through H mod Z, which you identify with in the obvious way, with those elements in C star whose modulus is between 0 and 1. Okay. So now what given such an annulus parametrized by tau, we need to get a functor from C to itself, right? So it turns out this functor fixes the underlying vector space, which is the representation of the vertex algebra. So, I said vertex algebras have representations, let's assume they are vector spaces. So this functor takes a representation, gives you another representation, but the underlying vector space remains the same. And this functor is equivalent to the identity functor. So what you actually get by taking the natural equivalence between the identity functor and this C tau is an operator. It's an element, it's a way of assigning a tau to an automorphism of the vector space V. So this is not an automorphism in as written, it's just an automorphism of vector spaces, right? It is the natural transformation between what C of tau gives you on the vector space and the vector space itself. So you get this operator, this assignment that sends tau to an automorphism of the vector space V. Now, remember our functors need to compose under concatenation of Riemann surfaces. Now, you can concatenate annuli by suitably scaling one of these annuli so that the inner circle becomes the outer circle for the next one, and now you just put one inside the other. So that gives you a monoid structure in H mod Z, which is your standard monoid structure, right? H is a monoid, H mod Z is a monoid. That's the monoid structure in H mod Z. If you work it out, it is precisely concatenation of annuli. And the way the modular functor needs to work, that really tells you that this Q to the L0 is a homomorphism. So I've defined this operator Q to the L0 using just the theory of conformal blocks. It's a homomorphism. Okay, so now I want to bring up an extremely important example that's going to be relevant for everything we're going to talk about. And this example is that of a rational VOA. It's called the level K vacuum. And what it is that I'm not going to define a vertex algebra. So this object that I'm going to talk about, this vertex algebra, the level K vacuum, I'll really talk about its category of representations, because really that's what's important in what we're talking about. So it turns out its category of representations can be identified with level K positive energy representations of the loop group. So what do I mean by all these things? So let me lead you through what I mean by all of these things. So I'm going to set G to be a simple, simply connected compact Lie group with maximal torus T and vial group W, which is the normalizer of T mod T. And we'll call LG the group of smooth loops in G, so under pointwise composition. So this group, it has a central extension, a universal central extension, and I'll denote that by LG tilde, okay? And now, since you're looking at smooth loops, you can always rotate a loop or reparametrize the incoming circle that's mapping into G, right? So there's a rotation group that I'm going to label by this boldface T, and that rotates your loops. So the rotation goes this way. Maybe there should be a minus here, to be fair, but it doesn't matter. It's abelian. So, you know, you could take e to the i theta, which is an element in T, and take a loop and rotate them in this way. So it turns out that this T action on LG, which is by homomorphism, actually lifts to an action of T on the central extension, again by homomorphism. So what we can do is to construct this semi-direct product, which I'll call script G, because it's cumbersome to write it as a semi-direct product again and again. So script G is the T extended central extension of the loop group. All right, now it turns out that this script G has a larger maximal torus because you've added two circles. You had the maximal torus T sitting inside G, and G sits inside LG as like the constant loops. So there's that torus that sits inside this, but there's also the central circle that comes from the central extension, which is this S1. And then there is this rotation circle. And you can see they all commute with each other the way I've defined it. So this is in fact a maximal torus in this larger group, and it has its own vial group. And that vial group is known as the affine vial group. And it has an interesting structure. It has a structure of a lattice extended by the finite vial group. So this is the fundamental group of the torus. It has an obvious action of the vial group, the finite vial group. This is the one without the tilde. And you can look at the semi-direct product, and that's the object that's isomorphic to the affine vial group. All right, so here's what happens. So you fix an integer k bigger than zero, and you look at the category C sub k of unitary representations of this loop group with certain properties. And so what you require is that these representations have a constant character of degree k on the center. So the center, which was that S1, acts by a degree k character on all of these representations. And you require that the negative modes of this. So you take a representation, decompose it as under the rotation circle, you know all the characters. You demand that the characters of this representation there's only finitely many characters for any of those representations in negative modes. Okay, so that's called a positive energy. So that's what this condition is, positive energy unitary representations. So here's how I'm going to talk about the category of representations of VOA. I'm going to say there's a fictitious VOA out there. Actually, it exists. It's called the level K vacuum, or its simple quotient, whose representations, the category of representations, are precisely the category that we talked about with the loop group upstairs. So let me now start introducing objects that will be relevant for the topology, my goal, right? I said I want to construct a K-theory spectrum. So let's look at this rigidification functor. So what this functor does, it goes from this category to the category of Hilbert spaces, and it takes a representation and just gives you the underlying Hilbert space. So remember, representation, these are unitary representations. So take a representation, just pick out its underlying Hilbert space. And now from this data, let's construct a sort of a universe. A Hilbert space We'll call that a Hilbert space dominated by this functor as the smallest Hilbert space that contains each irreducible representation of the loop group with infinite multiplicity. So one way to construct such a Hilbert space, they're all equivalent, they're all isomorphic. One way to do it would take every irreducible, remember this is semi-simple, just take every irreducible and add it up infinitely many times, take the entire generated vector space and then complete it with the Hilbert space norm, and you get a Hilbert space, the smallest Hilbert space that contains every irreducible infinite with infinite multiplicity. All right, this leads me to an important object that is essentially the meat of everything. It's called the dominant K theory. So the dominant K theory is going to be a spectrum. The underlying infinite loop space of the spectrum, or the underlying spectrum, if you forget the loop group completely, is just going to be your regular K theory, the usual K theory that satisfies Bott periodicity, you know, Z cross BUU, Z cross BUU. And here's here's my, Hilbert space. It's given by, it's modeled by Fredholm operators on this underlying Hilbert space. Remember, the Hilbert space comes with a representation, but if I forget the representation, I'm just getting Fredholm operators on this Hilbert space, which, like I said, is Z cross BUU, Z cross BU. So it gives you a spectrum. But of course, this guy comes with an action. It's a representation of the loop group, and it's a unitary representation. So this guy actually acts by conjugation on the Fredholm operators. And now what you do is you look at the space of Fredholm operators, which is the infinite loop space of this spectrum. But I think of this now as a spectrum which is an equivariant spectrum. It's a spectrum with an action of this guy. And one of the things you can show, and it's in the literature here, is that the entire unitary group on a Hilbert space, this de-looping, this infinite de-looping, the construction of a spectrum can be made compatible with the action of the unitary group. So this is in fact an equivariant spectrum, not just at zeroth space, not just the infinite loop space, the entire spectrum is equivariant with this action. Again, because it sits inside the unitary group for the Hilbert space. All right, so it's an important property about this spectrum is that if I pick any compact Lie group, compact subgroup, which ends up, it turns out that every compact subgroup inside this spectrum here, remember there's no central extension here. If I take any compact subgroup here, it turns out that compact subgroup is in fact a compact Lie group. So let's take a compact subgroup, which turns out to be a compact Lie group. Remember, the action of this object is by conjugation. However, this is not a representation of this object. What it is a representation of its central extension. However, since you're acting by conjugation, the center doesn't act. So the conjugation action of the central extension of this actually factors through an action of this group, right? So remember, there's a small difference. This is not a representation of this. It is a representation of its central extension, but the action by conjugation factors through this. So this group here has an equivariant K-theory spectrum, which is not this guy, right? Or is not even related to this guy, because this guy is not a representation of this of H. It's a representation of the central extension. So what I mean by saying that this guy is a spectrum, which is a module over the K-theory spectrum of H, is this. Here's how I see it. So take the induced central extension. Now H sits in here. Look at the induced central extension H acquires, because this guy has a universal central extension. So H acquires a central extension. We'll call that H tilde. Now this Hilbert space is in fact a representation of H tilde. And the claim, what this previous paragraph really says is that Hilbert space is closed under tensoring with H representation, pull back to this, right? Remember, if you take an H representation, pull it back to this, the center will act by the same character. So you can tensor representations of this guy with H representations under pullback, and you can ask for that to lie inside this Hilbert space. And one of the properties of this Hilbert space is that is in fact the case. Now, if you reproduce this, what this paragraph says, it really tells you that this K-theory spectrum is a module spectrum over the standard equivariant K-theory of H. Okay, the important thing you bear in mind is if you interpret these things correctly, just apply pi naught to it, it says that the fixed point spectrum here under H is a module over the representations of H. So rep H module, right? Rep H is the pi naught of the standard equivariant K theory of H. And this guy here being a module over the equivariant K theory of H ends up having a rep H module structure when you take H fixed points. So that's an important property. So now what I want to do is to extend all of this, go back to this idea of my moduli of annuli we talked about before. Remember, I showed you that H mod Z was a space that parametrized annuli, right? Annuli, the standard annuli and standard position, outer circle being the standard circle, inner circle being parametrized by either 2 pi I tau. How do you see this? Well, it turns out that this guy here, H mod Z, obviously sits inside C star. We talked about it. And that C star is a complexification of this rotation circle. Remember, we had this genus zero evolution operator that took an element in here and gave you an automorphism of a representation. Turns out that automorphism of the representation is precisely the automorphism you get by including this inside C star, which is a complexification of this T. So the rotation action, the T action on V, you know, seeing T as a part of the group script G here, this, the inclusion of T inside G acting on V is precisely the one that complexifies to the action of this. So another way to say that is that the Lie, this H here, which is the Lie algebra of this monoid, is really an open domain in the Lie algebra of T and the complexification of the Lie algebra of T. So if you have a situation like that, the natural thing to do is to extend to the entire Lie algebra, right? H was a subspace of the Lie algebra of T, but T is a subgroup inside this loop group here, the extended loop group here. So what I want to do is to complexify the entire Lie algebra of this group. We'll call that, extend H to the complexification of this Lie algebra. So the object I want to consider instead of H is H cross the script GC, where this guy is simply the complexification of the Lie algebra of this. So it's a natural extension of H because H was the complexification of the Lie algebra of this rotation circle. Okay, now this is not an ad hoc thing. It comes very motivated. So let me give you another way to understand the complexification of the Lie algebra of LG. So what you want to think of it as, you think of it as the cotangent bundle of the space of G connections on S1. If you look at G connections on S1, it's an affine space modeled on the Lie algebra of LG, okay? And so when you complexify it, you can identify it with a cotangent bundle of this. So this guy here is really the cotangent bundle of the space of G connections on S1, and that goes by the name of classical 2D gauge fields in the annuli, or also by the classical phase space. Okay, so that's the object that you want to think of if you are so inclined by what I am doing here. So that explains why I call this extending the module of annuli by the phase space, because I'm throwing in this Lie algebra, which has a geometric description. All right, so what I want to do next is to take this guy here, H cross GC. This is the complexified Lie algebra of the loop group. And this whole object comes with an action of C star cross C star semi-direct product LG. So this group acts by the adjoint representation on this Lie algebra. And what I want to do is to define its GIT quotient. So let me take just a couple of minutes and tell you what I mean by GIT quotient here. So this terminology here, I can understand it's somewhat confusing. You know, people write stacks this way. People in the world of GIT quotients write, you know, GIT quotients this way. And then there's also the symplectic quotients also written this way. So let me just take a few minutes so to explain what I mean by GIT quotients, because I'll be using that throughout this talk. So whenever you have a situation of an algebraic group like this, or maybe infinite dimensional, acting on some algebraic variety like this, and say I can write this sort of like an Artin stack, meaning locally I can write it as some nice algebraic variety with an algebraic group acting on it. So something like, you know, algebraic variety with an algebraic group acting on it, then in this situation, I can give sort of local functions on this, turn this entire object into an analytic variety by defining local functions as the HC invariant functions on this variety. So the local sheaf of functions on the GIT quotient is defined by taking the local structure of this, taking the functions on this HC and taking the invariance under the group. So, and then taking spec of that if you want. So that's how one talks about a GIT quotient. So GIT quotient, again, is just spec of the invariant functions locally. All right, so that's what I'm gonna mean by GIT quotients throughout. So it sits underneath the stack, but it's a more refined and important object. Okay, so it turns out that when I take the GIT quotient of this Lie algebra with the adjoint action of this complexified loop group extended by this torus, it can locally be written as the Lie algebra of an algebraic subgroup which happens to be the complexification of some compact connected subgroup in this. So there exists a compact connected subgroup in this guy that complexifies to an algebraic subgroup here, and look at its adjoint action on the complexification of its Lie algebra. That is the local model of this guy here. Okay, so now what I want to do is to use this information to construct this K-theory sheaf that I promised you in the beginning. So here's how it works. This object here is going to be my Bayes space. So I'm going to construct a sheaf on this object. Okay, this GIT quotient that we just talked about. And locally, this guy, remember, is given by this GIT quotient, which is the Lie algebra of HC with HC acting on itself by conjugation. And over this open set, I'm going to associate the spectrum given by the H fixed points of this dominant K theory that I constructed, right? Remember, the groups, the homotopy groups of this were a module over the standard Ekman K theory of H. So you have this map from the representation ring of H. Now the representations obviously are class functions that you could think of them as H invariant functions on the complexified Lie algebra. So there's a natural map of rings from the representation ring of H into H invariant functions on this. By the way, H invariant functions are also HC invariant functions because you can always complexify the invariants. So this is the same as what we mean by this guy here. So there's a ring map from this to this. So you can use this ring map to induce this spectrum up to functions on this. Right, on the GIT quotient. So so it turns out what you get is, by definition, by construction, a sheaf of spectra over this GIT quotient, A. All right, and what is this sheaf of spectra? Turns out it's a derived line bundle over A. So what do I mean by a derived line bundle? So let me explain that. And remember, working over characteristic zero. So it's a derived line bundle over A. So let me explain that. So working over C, I'm going to write this GIT quotient, the one we just constructed, in a different way. Turns out you can write it using just the Lie algebra of the maximal torus. And you could see why that might be the case. It's a variant of on the idea that you know, every element in the Lie group can be conjugated into its maximal torus, and then you're left with the Weyl group acting on it. So it turns out characteristic zero of this GIT quotient is the same as a GIT quotient you obtain by taking H and then the Lie algebra of the torus T. Remember, the center is not playing any part here. We're working with the loop group of just loops on G extended by the torus, the rotation circle. The center is not here. Okay, so I'm going to take H, which was an open domain in the Lie algebra of T complexified, and then I take the Lie algebra of the standard maximal torus of G and complexify it. That object comes with an action of the affine Weyl group. And that GIT quotient is precisely the same as this quotient. All right. The action, so we had this action of the Weyl group on this vector space, well, sort of open domain in a vector space. That action actually extends to a larger group. So the action of the affine Weyl group on this domain extends to a group that I'm going to call W tilde 2z, because it's basically an SL2z extension by throwing in an extra lattice. So the Weyl group here is acting diagonally on both these lattices, like we saw. It acts on either one of them, so it could act on both of them diagonally. And then you have SL2z that sort of acts sending one to the other. So this group over here acts on this rank, this lattice, you know, added to itself. And so this is a larger group that extends the action of the affine Weyl group, and that action extends to this complex vector space. And what you could do is you take the GIT quotient under this larger discrete symmetry, right? And that the whole picture fits into a commutative diagram like this. A was this one where I took the Lie algebra, I took this Lie algebra of the torus, and I just killed the affine Weyl group. And clearly that maps to H mod mod Z. And here I have M mapping to A, the moduli elliptic curves. So you have a commutative diagram like this. So this object here, very well studied, right? It's the moduli space of principal G connections of the universal elliptic curve. You think of this as the moduli of elliptic curves. And for each elliptic curve, you think of the flat connections on that corresponding elliptic curve. So what you get is the moduli space of flat connections of the universal elliptic curve. This guy supports a line bundle called the Luenga line bundle. line bundle. And it's also called the pre-quantum line bundle for reasons that are based in Chern-Simons theory. So this guy has a line bundle, we'll call that script L. I can pull that line bundle over here. And but before I do that, I just want to make an observation here. When you take the pre-quantum line bundle here and you take its holomorphic sections, meaning pointwise. So you take an elliptic curve here, look at the fiber here, look at the Liouville line bundle on that fiber, take holomorphic sections in the Liouville line bundle on that fiber, that gives you a vector space. That vector space organizes itself over the modular elliptic curves. And it turns out that that is precisely the genus one conformal blocks for this category we were talking about, right? So genus one conformal blocks with no points. These are elliptic curves with no marked points. You can make sense of conformal blocks for them as well. Then for that, what you get is this vector bundle that sits over the modular elliptic curves, and that is precisely the vector bundle of conformal blocks, which comes with a projectively flat connection. Anyway, we had that line bundle here, the Liouville line bundle. I pull it back to A, and it turns out that the homotopy groups of the spectrum we constructed are precisely the pullback of the k-fold tensor power of that bundle to A. Okay, so that's why I called it a derived line bundle, because you have something so that when you take its homotopy groups, remember we're working over the complex numbers, it turns out what it is, it's simply the sections of the k-fold tensor power of L pulled back to A. Remember, A did not have the whole W2 tilde Z acting on it, just had W acting on it. So you can ask for how much of this guy acts on the line bundle pulled back to A. Turns out you have to take a double cover. And when you take the double cover, then the homotopy groups or the holomorphic sections of this bundle pulled back to A does have an action of the double cover. Okay. What you can do is now take invariance in two steps. First, take the invariance under W semidirect product this guy. And it turns out that those invariant sections under just this part here are also identifiable with the W invariant theta functions. Okay, and now this is known to be a basis of representations of loop group at that level. So if I take the holomorphic sections of this and I just take invariants under this guy here, which is a small piece, well, it's a fairly substantial piece of this, but it misses the SL2Z. You take invariants of this section, invariance on the holomorphic sections of this guy under this group, what you get is the W invariant theta functions, and which these guys are precisely the characters of the level K representations of the loop group. But remember, we didn't take invariance under the whole SL2Z, the whole group W2, so there is an SL2Z action that remains. So what we've done is recover Joos' theorem as a statement about the homotopy groups of this, right?
Just a quick question. What is the thing from the homotopy of the sheaf of your K-theory spectrum correspond to in terms of the Liouville line bundles?
It's the global sections of the Liouville line bundle.
So when you say the homotopy, there's a pi star there, right? There's a gradient that's the star.
Yes.
What is that star in terms of the holomorphic sections of these Liouville bundles?
So you can take sections locally, stockwise, and that'll be the germs of holomorphic sections.
I just don't understand what corresponds to the homotopical gradient.
So don't worry about it. It's all pi zero. It's a periodic spectrum, and okay. I'm just doing pi zero right now.
Okay, gotcha.
Okay, so just take pi zero. Remember, this is two periodic, right? Our spectra were two periodic. Equivariant K theory is two periodic when I take fixed points. So my line bundle, my sheaf of spectra here, every stock is going to be two periodic, and so I just choose pi naught. And what I get is the holomorphic sections of this line bundle.
Awesome, thanks.
All right. So what we've done right now is notice that Joos' theorem in this special case can be enhanced to the homotopy groups of an object we've created, global object. Right. Notice also that inside these W equivalent theta functions, there is an SL2Z invariant element where you add up all of these theta functions with multiplicity one. And so that's a class in the global sections of this spectrum that we've just constructed, right? If you take global sections, you take pi naught, you get this class. We'll call that bracket WZW, and it stands for chiral WZW. You don't have to know what that means. If you don't know what that means, think of it as taking one of these generating theta functions with one multiplicity and adding them all up together. So we'll talk more about that later. So the important thing to remember is that in these sections, there is it's a canonical SL2Z invariant section called the WZW. So we've identified a chiral CFT inside sections of representations, or rather growth and degroups, So this is the moral that we're trying to push here. All right, so now let's probe this. So I've constructed a spectrum, remember. So we've constructed a spectrum. It's not just a vector bundle, it's a spectrum. So when you have a sheaf of spectra, you could do something that you can't do with vector spaces, that is to say, probe it, right? You can throw things at it. You can throw manifolds at it and try to calculate the answer. So let's do that. Let's introduce what's called a background manifold. So what do I mean by this? So before I get there, let's see what we've reached so far. Let's sort of recap here. What we've done is we've constructed what I call is a derived categorical quantization, because I have taken a category of level k representations, and I've constructed a derived spectrum on it. And why do I call it a quantization procedure? Because what I constructed was a derived version of the pre-quantum line bundle over this space, right? Remember, I called something a pre-quantum line bundle. There was a reason to call it a pre-quantum line bundle, and so you know, I want to call this a derived categorical quantization procedure. Derived because you get a spectrum, categorical because it is the K theory of the representations of the vertex algebra or the loop group, and it comes as sections of a certain pre-quantum line bundle. So I call that a quantization procedure. It also came with some extra piece of information that was useful. It came with a canonical element, the chiral WZW model. And if you know what that is, you understand that it has an underlying modular functor, and that is precisely the modular functor that we started off with to make this construction. All right, now what I want to do is to introduce a manifold M. It's a G manifold M, okay? So if you believe in this philosophy here, there's a philosophy that I'm positing here that I'm doing a sort of a quantization procedure, right? I'm working with annuli, which are basically circle that is thickened. So for those annuli, I construct a space, and I then construct a line bundle on the space, and I take, you know, construct a, you know, make it derived line bundle, and sections give me the right object. If you believe that this philosophy must follow through, then what I really need to replace this base space by is by A times the loop space of M. Okay, so that it's based concretely in the idea that what you have is a 2D theory, and these are the fields in dimension one. So what you want to do is to replace A by, change it, thicken it by A times the loop space of M, right? You think of it simply as a topological G space. Remember, this was a GIT quotient, it's an analytic space. This is simply a topological space. And when I do this, I want to then probe my derived spectrum with this as the base, right? So another way to put that is, instead of putting LM in the base, I put it as a mapping spectrum, right? I take the maps from LM into this spectra, and I think of that as a derived spectrum over A. So it's just adjointness here. Now this is a G space, meaning it's a space with a loop group action, the extended loop group, the rotation circle plus the G loop group, the entire thing acts on this. So there is an obvious action on this entire spectrum by the loop group. And so what I could do is I can construct a derived spectrum over A whose value on this local piece here is simply given by taking fixed points of this mapping spectrum under H. So I'm doing exactly what I did in constructing my derived spectrum. I'm just throwing in LM as part of the mapping space here, right? So if M was a point, this just recovers my line bundle, the derived line bundle. All right, so now what you could do is you could look at the homotopy stocks of this sheaf, and it turns out what they localize around a very interesting subspace of LM, right? So topologists call this subspace ghost loops in LM. Basically, they are loops that follow G orbits in M. But if you're a physicist, you can interpret these guys in a different way. These are known as the genus one symplectic vortex equations, which by the way, can be seen as gauge J holomorphic curves. So you think of, you know, these elliptic curves mapping into M, and then you basically think of them as J holomorphic curves, but then you gauge it. So you sort of throw in a connection, so you don't have the D bar operator, you have D-bar twisted by the connection. And so what you get is a situation where you can gauge it. You get gauge J holomorphic curves, but not in M, but in its tangent bundle, because, you know, M is not a symplectic manifold, but its tangent bundle is a symplectic manifold, throwing in a metric on M, which is irrelevant. So this becomes a symplectic manifold, and you can talk about J holomorphic curves in TM. It turns out if you look at this space and you calculate it, it's essentially the ghost loops. It factors, you know, there's a map from this object to this with contractible fibers. So it's an extremely interesting object. And this is the object you would expect if you were doing sort of like classical right? If you're trying to map elliptic curves locally, you would expect to take J-holomorphic curves that are gauged. So it makes sense that the sheaf that we're getting here gets localized about this space here. Now these equations, these J-holomorphic equations, they're local in M. So another way to say that is that this guy, this mapping spectrum here, it turns out to be a cohomological functor in M. This is completely non-obvious, right? Loop space on M is not a cohomological functor in M, right? You can't break loops by breaking M into open sets. However, when you localize about these sort of symplectic vortex equations or gauge J-holomorphic curves, it turns out, or ghost loops, if you will, turns out that that object is local in M. And so what you get is an equivariant cohomology theory on M. M was a G-manifold, equivalent cohomology theory. And you know, when constructed the way I have, it seems to bear some resemblance to the construction of Gronowski, but it's not explicit at all. And when I did it, you know, it wasn't clear to me that what you're getting was the same equivalent elliptic cohomology that Gronowski constructed, and then several other people that I've listed here have studied. But then, you know, a very beautiful thesis by Matthew Spong studied all the relations between Gronowski's construction, and then there was you know, Charles's construction and the construction that I've just described, and showed that in almost all of those cases they are the same, meaning for almost all manifolds M that are nice enough, they are the same. And then there was, of course, the issue, is it actually true for every single M? And then it was pointed out to me by a postdoc of mine, Valentin, that in Roshu's paper, you could, you know, delve deep into the paper and find a churn character type argument that actually extends to show that this equivariant cohomology theory you've constructed is in fact isomorphic to the ones constructed by any of these over here.
I believe there's a mistake in that particular churn character argument by Roshu. That's where the equivariant formal condition came from, that there's a map that's supposed to be injective, but you can only see that it's injective for equivariantly formal spaces.
Oh, I see. This is news to me. Thank you for pointing out. Was that Nora?
Yeah, that was Nora.
Yeah, okay. All right. So then I stand by Matthew's thesis. I hope, Nora, that's correct.
Yeah. I mean, that condition in Matthew's thesis comes from some small inaccuracy in Ioannid's paper. And I've written to Ioannid about that, asking whether it can be fixed. But Ioannid was saying he's been away from math for too long.
Understandably. Okay, mm-hmm. Let's leave that as an open question, whether this construction of this equivariant cohomology theory is indeed the same constructed by all of the authors that I've listed here. It turns out that at least for some of these interesting spaces, they are the same. And these are the spaces that Matthew considered. Okay, so we have a cohomology theory that wants to be the same as equivariant elliptic cohomology listed by all of these guys, but we can only establish that for some manifolds. I'll come to this later. It turns out that these guys here have listed something that's incredibly interesting. So I'll get to it. There's properties in the construction made by all of these authors, you know, starting with Gronowski and then Matthew and Ioannid and Charles and again Matthew and Dan and Arnav, and these constructions have a property that I have not been able to establish. And so knowing these two are isomorphic is actually very useful. But let's go through a fun fact here. Let's take T to be a torus. This theory, the construction that I have made, clearly doesn't apply to a torus because a torus is not a simply connected compact Lie group. So we don't, you know, this construction doesn't give you a T equivariant cohomology theory. It only gives you a G equivariant cohomology theory for simply connected Lie groups, compact Lie groups. But what you could try to do is to try to take T inside G. So let's take a simply connected Lie group, and let's say T is a maximal torus inside G. And then for a T space, I can sort of induct up and construct a G space by just inducing up to a G space, and then try to calculate the G equivariant elliptic cohomology of this guy. So this would be my proxy for T equivariant cohomology, provided, you know, the central extensions work out. Because remember, all of this, you know, the data that comes in is this level K. So let's check what you get when you set M to be a point. When you set M to be a point, this just gives you G mod T. I'm sorry, not M to be a point, my fault. X to be a point. This is a typo here. You set X to be a point, you get M as G mod T, and what you're doing is you're calculating this equivariant cohomology applied to G mod T, and you calculate the answer. You could do this by hand, and you get all the level K characters, I'm sorry, you get all level K theta functions for this lattice, and the lattice pi 1 of T comes with the scaled Cartan killing form, right? Because T was a subgroup of G, so the Cartan killing form restricts to give you a form here and you scale it by K. So you're talking about theta functions on this lattice for that form, and you get exactly all of them, which is exactly what you would have expected to get if you had a theory that did the right thing you'd want. So this is a fun fact. Of course, this depends on choice of embedding, which of course ended up, you know, giving you some constraints on what form you take. And it's not clear to me, or it's not obvious to me, that it's probably not even true that all the forms you, quadratic forms you take, come induced from some embedding, let alone a maximal torus. All right, let me now get to the last third of my talk, which is work in progress. So there, what I'm going to say has a lot of moving parts here, and they need to be checked. So please take that with a grain of salt, but here's a picture that I believe is true. So we've been working over the complex numbers. What you want to do is really work over Z. So when you think about this, what you notice is that, remember, we extended our annuli by this linear phase space, which was just the Lie algebra of the loop group with this open domain in the Lie algebra of the rotation circle. What you want to do is to replace that by the non-linear phase space underneath this guy. So this guy here is a Lie algebra of a group. This is the group for which it is a Lie algebra. So you change this this linear phase space by this non-linear phase space. Okay. When you do that, you're still taking GIT quotients, right? Here you had the adjoint representation, and here you'll get the conjugation representation. So it's the same thing. So the map from here to here, if you will, is compatible with the adjoint action on both sides. Now, this guy here, this complexified loop group, where I'm only taking the domain here, it has an algebraic variant. And by that, I mean you can take the points. So you take the GC, so G was your compact Lie group, you complexify it, you take GC, and you take its points in the function, on the regular functions on C star. So just, you know, C, Q, Q inverse. So by this, I mean just complex numbers with Q and Q inverse, right? So these are the functions on C star. So take those points, that ring, and apply, take points of this group, algebraic group on that ring, and then of course C star acts on it. So this object here, it's an algebraic object, that's called the Kac-Smoothe group. And what it is, it's the algebraic variant of this smooth loops, right? The good thing about the Kac-Smoothe group is that it's defined over Z. This Kac-Smoothe group can be defined over any ring. In fact, it's defined over Z. So you could take its GIT quotients and hope that that Z form stays preserved. And in fact, that is what happens. If you take this group and you look at its GIT quotient with the action of itself by conjugation, and let's call that GIT quotient M, its local model is of the form HC mod mod HC. Remember, previously we had the Lie algebra. Here I have the actual group acting on itself by conjugation. And the good thing here, which is what we were hoping for, is that these HCs, in fact, are complex points of an algebraic group that is defined over Z. In other words, the Z form this guy had stays preserved when you take GIT quotients in a local way. So these objects here are, in fact, complex points of something that can be defined over Z. So this the GIT quotient for this Kac-Smoothe group is, in fact, defined over Z. Now let's look at what, remember, when you take a GIT quotient, a local GIT quotient, its functions are precisely the invariance of the functions on HC, right? That's the definition of the sheaf of functions on a GIT quotient. You have to take the functions on HC and then take invariant functions on their conjugation. Now, one of the properties about being split is that its maximal torus is a product of GMs, the multiplicative group. So when you take invariant functions, you're just taking functions on the maximal torus that are invariant. You're getting the representation ring on the nose. So the functions on the GIT quotient is a representation ring on the nose. So there's no complex coefficients or anything involved. This is an integral statement. So now I can construct my pre-quantum line bundle over this Z form exactly the same way, because locally when I work over this open set, the spectrum I had precisely coefficients that were the representation ring. They were modules over these coefficients. So I can extend my theory precisely over this stack because I know it's a module over this. So what I get is a line bundle over this, over the Z form, called the pre-quantum line bundle. Okay, but look, that's not the right bundle. This derived line bundle that I have, and I'm calling it a line bundle just in analogy, I'm not claiming it is a line bundle, it's a derived spectrum, a derived K-theory spectrum over MZ. I'm calling it a line bundle simply because it was a line bundle in the complex coefficients case. But it is the wrong line bundle if you work with geometric quantization. Because if you work with geometric quantization, what you want is to correct the line bundle. So remember, you had the moduli of elliptic curves, it supported the Liouville line bundle, you took global sections of it. The right thing to do there is to not take the Liouville line bundle, but to shift it by another level called, given by the dual Coxeter number of your Lie group G. So you take the level, shift it up by this, and that corresponds to a square root of the volume form on M. So this is the right line bundle to work with, and that's called the metaplectically corrected derived line bundle. So I'm going to work with this spectrum because that's what I'm told is the right spectrum. And the reason in geometric quantization that one does this correction is because you want to have your Hilbert spaces to be invariant under transformations in your Bayes manifold. And to get that to work naturally, you want to take a square root of the volume form. And that's where this H check comes in, because if you look at the moduli space of elliptic curves, canonical divisor, it's the top volume form is generated by twice H. So if you take its square root, you just get H. Right. So let's compute the homotopy of this guy, right? Global sections, homotopy of global section. So what you do that, what you're getting. So you have a sheaf, you look at its homotopy, and you do something that Leonard told us not to do, is to calculate stockwise homotopy and then look at the sheaf cohomology of that guy. It turns out in this case, it won't really matter because the sheaf cohomology is concentrated in degree n. So I'm going to take the homotopy of this and calculate the sheaf cohomology of that sheaf over the space mz, right? The analytic space mz. It turns out it's concentrated in degree n, where n is a rank of g, and it agrees with the Verlinde algebra level k. So what that is, it's the integral growth ND group of CK. So it is in fact a free Z module indexed by the irreducible representations of level K of the loop group or the vertex algebra, the vacuum vertex algebra. Okay, so it gives you the exact same thing, and you have to invoke serializability because of this N somewhere. Once you invoke serializability, what this does is recovers the theorem of Fried-Hopkins and Telemann on the nose. So you get the right coefficients. Let me make 2 points about this MZ here. So the first thing is, if I take complex points of MZ over some elliptic curve, so now if I take complex points, so then I can look at the fiber over some elliptic curve, I'm sorry, some annulus in H mod Z. Turns out the fiber is precisely the moduli of flat G connections on elliptic curves. However, it has already incorporated the W action, because notice that we've constructed this globally from the Katz-Muthy group. So the W action was already incorporated. So this fiber is not a Jacobian of any form, as opposed to the classical constructions of the moduli of flat connections, where you construct the Jacobian and then you think of it as equivariant object under the Weyl group. So the W action has been incorporated. And so the fiber is the moduli of flat connections, but it already, has the W action in it. In particular, it's not an abelian variety of any form. Okay, another interesting observation you get here is that the whole construction is equivariant with respect to automorphisms of the loop group, which, by the way, the outer automorphisms are given by Dinkin diagram automorphisms for G. So the affine Dinkin diagram. So if you look at the affine Dinkin diagram for all of these loop groups, they're very interesting. They have interesting automorphisms. So in the simple case of AN or the affine AN, which is affine loop group on SUN, it's like a cyclic group of order N minus one, I believe. So N plus one. And so, did I get that right? Yeah. It's either N plus one, N minus one, sorry about that. So you get a cyclic group that acts on this whole construction. And you may have to, to get that action to work on the nose, what you need to do is to take some fractional powers of Q. You're not introducing any coefficients. You're just simply taking Q and raising it, extending coefficient by Q to the 1/2 or Q to the 1/3. It's just take fractional powers of Q. So it's some sort of isogeny on the base, okay? And so what you could do is when you do that, you get an action of this automorphism of the Dinkin diagram of this whole construction. So that presumably is helpful in constructing twisted versions of this. So let me end very quickly with an example. So I'm going to do the example of SU2. And so this is my cat smoothie group. So when I construct this GIT quotient of cat smoothie group acting on itself, I get a pushout diagram like this. And now this GL1 cross GL1, you want to think of as the rotation circle and the maximal torus, right? Rotation circle, maximal torus. So this entire thing is the maximal torus of the loop group. This guy here is the rotation circle, and these are constant loops. These are the loops that don't have any dependence of rotation. That's the SL2. So this is another subgroup of the loop group, which contains this product as a subgroup. And this guy here is an interesting subgroup. The rotation group is actually acting on an SL2Z here, and on an SL2 here, not SL2Z, sorry. This is SL2 as an algebraic group. The two come together as GL2. So GL2 has, you know, GL1 cross GN1 as its maximal torus. So this pushout diagram is precisely MZ. And so let's look at what happens when you take functions on it. When you take functions, remember the functions on this guy are just the representation. So you get Q plus or minus X plus or minus. Here, what you'll get is Q plus or minus and this sort of this polynomial character, X plus X inverse. Here, because there's a rotation action of one of the rotation circles, what you get is more or less the same as this, but there is a Q dependence on one of these guys. So you get, and I've written it so that everything sits inside this. So this is my object here. If you look at it, notice that these guys have a C star in it. So it's like the punctured affine line, and here you have the affine line. Another punctured affine line, right? So what this tells you is that this entire object is a P1 bundle over the punctured affine line, right? It is not a Jacobian, it's not an elliptic curve, it's a P1 bundle, in fact, over the punctured affine line. And notice that this is a Q, it's a positive power of Q. So this bundle, in fact, extends to the entire affine line. So this P1 bundle can be extended to the entire affine line. I am not claiming that the K-theory, the derived line bundle that we've constructed over this extends to the entire affine line. That's something to be checked or worked out. But certainly the GIT quotient can be defined over the entire affine line. So I want to end really briefly with an application mostly intended for the physicists in the audience. So here's our situation. We have this integral object, right? And I have this complex object. This is what I constructed before. This was the integral object. And I can extend coefficients from Z to C, and I get a map from here to here. And I think of this, or I would like us to think of this, as a lattice. So think of this as, you know, some sort of Z form for this complex object here, right? Notice that, you know, modulo the error that Iwanid has in his, Iwanid Roshu has in his paper, or assuming that M is nice enough so that Matthew's results apply, this guy here is isomorphic to the Ekman elliptic cohomology constructed by the collection of authors I talked about. And I had mentioned to you that they showed something interesting about this guy that I was not able to show. They showed that the right-hand side has an SL2Z action. This guy here comes with an SL2Z action. Now that's not obvious at all from our construction. There's no reason to believe that our construction extends to the entire W2Z. So we could get it to extend to almost all of it except for the SL2. So this object here has no reason to have an SL2Z action the way we've constructed it. However, being isomorphic to the ones constructed by the others, this thing has an SL2Z action. This object here sure as hell does not have an SL2Z action for any M, right? You can't just choose a random M and hope to have an SL2Z action here. I would be very surprised that this lattice were SL2Z invariant. So this raises an incredibly interesting question. What are the elements in here that are SL2Z invariant in over here? Okay, so this potentially has some interesting applications to the sigma models in the large volume limit. And what I would like to say is that does this, you know, it's a question. Does this offer us obstructions to the existence of sigma models or large volume limits, things that can exist? Now, this is beyond my pay grade, so this is a question, really. I don't even know the answer to this question for a point, so let me explain what I mean. Remember, when I set M to be a point, this guy is basically theta functions, W invariant theta functions, coming with an SL2Z action as Zhu's theorem asked us, right? This guy has an SL2Z action because it gives you one theta function for each level K object, comes with an SL2Z action. This guy is a free Z module of the same rank, right? It's given by the Verlinde algebra. It has one Z generator for each element in irreducible representation of the loop group. So I don't know what the SL2Z invariant elements in here are. I mean, I'm happy with the fact that there is one interesting object on this side, the WZW model, where I take each of those irreducibles and add them up with multiplicity one, and I get an element in here that is invariant under SL2Z here. But then the question is, what are the other elements in this guy that are SL2Z invariant when you think of them here? And I actually don't know the answer, but I am pretty sure there's somebody out there who knows the answer, and I'm 4 minutes over, so I'll just end with a big thank you to everybody here.
All right, thank you for the talk, me too. Let's all give him a hand. Please feel free to unmute yourself. And let's open the floor for questions.
So, me too. There's it's easy to write down examples of pairs G and K, like G capital G comma little k, where the modular tensor categories are the same, but the functors rho are different for the different pairs. Like some Tanakhian story will recover G from the functor rho. How much of this story? I mean, obviously, once you're actually talking about G equivariant, you're invoking the letter G. But how much of these spectra, say just the non-equivariant spectra, for instance, how much of them depend on G, and how much depend on just the modular tensor category?
So the way, right, so that's a good question. And the way I've set it up, my phase space depends on G in a big way, right? I mean, so when you want to think of, the modular functor for Chern-Simons or something, you're constructing the line bundle over the moduli flat G connections, right? So you're taking your conformal blocks and sort of enriching them or globalizing them over the moduli of flat connections, and you have your line bundle there. So that's the analogy here. And so my answer would be, maybe this is not an answer, my question would be, is that thing sensitive to the G and K? And I assume it is, right? Moduli of K bundles is probably different from the moduli of G bundles, even though the conformal blocks might be the same. So we've done that enrichment, right? We've globalized everything over that phase space and then made it a nonlinear phase space. So that's a very sensitive object to the group. And remember, at the end of the day, we even want Z points. So that's going to be extremely sensitive to the group. So I suspect that this is, but you know, your question is an interesting question for general vertex algebras. Like, I start off with a vertex algebra that's not CK for any group G. How much of this can I actually do? And that's a very interesting question. I've thought about it, but you run into some problems. I mean, here's what you could do. You could take some primary fields in weight one, and let's say they create a Lie algebra, just like the, you know, the vacuum has the Lie algebra of the loop group generated by primary fields in weight one. And let's hope that, you know, now I can restrict everything to that. You take all your representations and restrict it to that Lie algebra, right? And so you could try to globalize these objects or think of them as elements in the representations of these loop groups, right? So you take a vertex algebra or take the modules over the vertex algebra, but then forget every piece of data about it and just retain the fact that it is a module over the vacuum vertex algebra, or you know, the Ketz-Moody vertex algebra sitting inside it because of weight one primary fields. And then think of it as sitting as an object in our derived K-theory here, and ask, well, what part of this do we see it? So, you know, you're getting elements in this coming from a vertex algebra. It's not gonna be all of them, presumably. Which ones do you get? Maybe there's a submodule of SL2Z invariant elements that you're getting. So, you know, I mean, I should have pointed this out, that if you have a conformal field theory, it will give you a rank one module over SL2Z in the image of this lattice, right? Because a conformal field theory is invariant under SL2Z. The state space is invariant. So that is it's an invariant of SL2Z. So the lattice is not invariant, but the image of the lattice clearly might contain invariant elements. And that's where you look for conformal field theories, like the WZW in our case. And you know, that's the question I have, right? How many other invariant elements are there in this? And hopefully you can try to identify other vertex algebras if they have the right Katz-Muhde symmetry inside that. And I don't know if that's going to work or what the obstructions there would be.
I just have a somewhat small technical question, which is that I was surprised your construction didn't work for a torus, as that's usually the easiest case in our construction. When we have a group that's, say, connected and has torsion-free fundamental group, that's usually good enough for the entire theory to go through, and getting away from torsion-free fundamental group or connectedness is when we need to, you know, work a little bit harder. So what goes wrong for your constructions if you just assume G is connected to torsion-free fundamental group?
What goes wrong? What would you take? Well, here's what goes wrong. Maybe it's a language issue. If you work with a torus, you'll end up working with a Jacobian, right? Your moduli of flat connections is the Jacobian variety. It's an abelian variety. And the way I see that, and I could be wrong and you could correct me, is that you're stuck with a Tate curve over there. Sort of, you know, you're working with complex coefficients. Because the only model you have is a Tate curve. You don't see this object that fibers over, the upper half plane, or, you know, punctured upper half plane. I'm sorry, it fibers over the affine line or the punctured affine line, but the fibers are not Jacobians, right? We just saw an example, a fiber was a P1. We saw that. And it's an interesting object it's not the object you would expect to get if you did everything over the complex numbers. If you did everything over the complex numbers, the objects you get are Jacobians, and then they come with the Weyl group action. And I don't know how to construct a global object besides the one you get from the Jacobian of the torus. And you can do that. My whole construction of the complex numbers will work for a torus as well, but it'll only work over the complex numbers. I can't see it work over the integers.
I don't think I understand what goes wrong over the integers. So over the moduli of elliptic curves or spin elliptic curves, indeed, you could consider the universal family of the elliptic curve with the dual elliptic curve. It doesn't make any difference. And your MZ that you're writing down, for the example of SL2, yeah, you're getting a P1. That P1 that you're getting is really just SIM2 of the elliptic curve, where you take a kernel of the addition map to the elliptic curve. It's really just the universal elliptic curve mod the Z2 action, which is involution. That's why you're getting your P1.
That's correct, yes.
So in some sense, just as well defined over the global moduli of elliptic curves as the universal elliptic curve.
So what would you get if you tried to do this for a torus? What you would have to incorporate inside there would be a lattice, right? So what would you get? You'd get a complex or any integral torus. How would you take the quotient with a lattice?
Right, could you say again, maybe in the SL2 case, where you're getting your lattice from a P1.
So you're not getting a lattice. That's the point I'm trying to make. I don't, my construction never ever goes through a lattice. That's only, you know, the isomorphism over the complex numbers can be posited using a lattice. For a semi-simple group, there is no lattice. You're taking this diagram, this push-out diagram we talked about. Nowhere in that push-out diagram was a lattice. But if you're doing it for a torus, you're going to have to incorporate that lattice in the integer points. And so my question is, how would one do that?
By the lattice, do you mean if I choose to uniformize my torus and write it as an affine space model lattice, I could just not do that, right?
You can do that, but it'll only work over the complex numbers.
Yeah, exactly. So let's just not do that.
And now, so how would you then construct? So how would you construct that moduli as Z points? From what would you start? What is the object whose Z points are that?
Sure. It's the object whose S points are families of elliptic curves over S, and then families of line bundles over that family of elliptic curves over S. It's the universal Jacobian over the moduli of elliptic curves, which is well defined as a stack over Z.
And locally, what does that stack look like so you can construct your sheaf of K-theory spectra?
Locally, it's the universal elliptic curve over the moduli of elliptic curves.
Right, so the problem is that I don't have a local model that allows me to take H fixed points for compact Lie groups H. what I want is compact Lie groups H, right? Remember, our K-theory spectrum locally is the fixed points under a compact Lie group H, where the complexification of H is the algebraic group, the split form of the algebraic group, which is the local model for your moduli space, right? So moduli space locally is HC or HC, sorry, HC mod mod HC. And over that, I'm going to construct my spectrum, which is the H fixed points of this K-theory. So you need a local structure to be able to do that. And I don't see how to do that for a torus.
I see. Okay, thank you. Any other questions? We'll certainly have the room still open afterwards. I'm not sure how long Neetu is going to want to stay tonight.
I could stay a bit.
All right, great. So we can have some informal discussion afterwards. But maybe with that, let's thank our speaker again. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to thank everybody again.